This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're taking stock of the state of sports in the City Beautiful, looking at college football, Major League Soccer, and the Orlando Magic. Are you a Magic fan? Are you wearing your Magic jersey with pride once more as the fortunes of the team look up? Could this be the season they make the playoffs? Do you share the frustration of UCF's Knights shut out of a playoff semifinal despite their winning streak? Is this a moment to rethink the way college football competitions are organized? And what about Orlando City Soccer? A revolving door of coaches in recent years has not helped their performance, so what's the secret to success for this young MLS team? Is the hype around soccer in Orlando dissipating? We're taking your calls at 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation online. Send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. And joining us is Jeff Sharon. He's the managing editor of the Black and Gold Banneret. Welcome back, Jeff.
Hi, Matthew. Good to see you.
Also joined by Philip Rossman-Reich. He's editor at Orlando Magic Daily and host of the podcast Locked On Magic. Thank you for joining us, Philip.
Thanks for having me.
And also joined by Jordan Culver. He's a staff writer at ProSoccerUSA.com. Jordan joins us from Atlanta, where he's there for the MLS finals at the moment. Jordan, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation. The number is 1-866-338-5252. You can send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. Jeff, let's start with you. Let's talk about what we saw from the UCF Knights this season. I mean, that winning record is unimpeachable, right?
25 wins in a row. It's actually tied for the sixth longest winning streak since the FCS split and 13th longest since the Second World War. If you can believe it, it's just been a phenomenal ride for UCF the entire way.
Mm-hmm. It's been kind of a bittersweet season, though, right? I mean, for one thing, despite the success, they have not made the playoffs.
That's right.
I'll confess, I don't quite understand how this whole thing works.
In the 14 playoff that we have, the college football playoff, it's the participants are chosen by a committee. There's no they claim that there's some sort of analytical information that's taken into account for the decisions, but nonetheless, you know, they decided to leave UCF out because, in their opinion, the goalposts kind of move a little bit depending on when you ask them why not UCF. But the larger opinion seems to be that because UCF plays in the American Athletic Conference, which is not one of the five power so-called conferences that we have in college football, that they don't play a tough enough schedule, and therefore they couldn't stack up against the other four teams. You can plug in any sort of data to try and back up that statement, but the bottom line is UCF is going to head into a New Year's Day bowl game against the LSU Tigers in Glendale, Arizona, the Fiesta Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
Winners of 25 games in a row, they have not lost a game since the Obama administration and have not actually even received a sniff of consideration for the college football playoff the last 2 years. And that's unfortunate.
And that's despite the fact that they went into the season with a new coach. Right.
Josh Heupel, in his first year, taking over for Scott Frost, who left UCF after 2 years to go to his alma mater, the University of Nebraska, took his entire staff with him. There were no holdovers. So Heupel comes in. They bring in Randy Shannon, who's a former head coach at the University of Miami and interim coach at the University of Florida, to run the defense. And it's really been a remarkable job by Josh Heupel. He's getting some consideration, well-deserved, I think, as well, for National Coach of the Year honors, because it's so hard to come in as a first-year head coach after what UCF did under Frost, coming off of that winless season in 2015,
mm-hmm.
building them into an undefeated season within 2 years. And anyone in athletics will tell you that it's hard to stay on top. And Heupel's mantra has been, go 1-0 every week. We don't have to worry about anything else. All we have to do is worry about going 1-0 on Saturday. And they've gone 1-0 12 times in a row. And so far it's worked.
Do you think Scott Frost might be regretting his decision a little bit?
Early in the season, it looked that way because Nebraska got off to a very bad start, but they sort of gotten their feet underneath them. I'm sure that people have asked him about UCF. He's more or less avoided the question.
Mm-hmm.
But he's recruited a number of players on this roster. I don't know if he would ever regret, leaving UCF to go to his alma mater. I personally think that Nebraska's the only job he would have left UCF for. It was a very difficult decision for him at the time. I'm sure he's happy to see a lot of the players that he brought into UCF continue to have success.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the state of sports in Orlando. You can join the conversation, 1-866-338-5252, talking about the UCF Knights continuing that winning season but not quite making it into the playoffs there. What are your thoughts? What could be done to give them a shot maybe next season, or does there need to be a major reorganization of the way college football is run? 1-866-338-5252. Also talking about Orlando City Soccer and the Orlando Magic. Kind of a roller coaster ride for Orlando sports fans at the moment. There's plenty of stuff to pay attention to. You can send us a tweet too. We're at WMFE Orlando. Getting a tweet here from Jorge. He writes, the UCF Knights, well, actually, he's just retweeting you, Jeff. The UCF Knights haven't lost since the Obama administration, but the CBF playoff haven't given them a sniff. We can talk more about what the options are. You know, maybe for shaking things up a little bit. We're hearing some interesting things from the SEC folks, but we want to hear from you too. So send us in your thoughts. We're at WMFE Orlando. Jordan, I want to turn to you now. You're in Atlanta. You're there for the final. It sounds like it's pretty lousy weather, but as we were saying before we got on air here, they're playing on an artificial turf under a roof, so there's no danger there for the players of getting a little bit cold. Doesn't sound like, you know, the classic English conditions you might find in the FA Cup or something in some of those matches over there. Tell us a little bit about what you're expecting to see from this MLS final, which unfortunately doesn't involve Orlando.
So it's Atlanta United versus the Portland Timbers, and it looks like it's shaping up to be one of the biggest American soccer events of all time. And I know Orlando City fans don't want to hear that in the slightest, but Mercedes-Benz Stadium is going to be packed. There's going to be at least 70,000 people there. Mercedes-Benz Stadium has just consistently crushed all attendance records in in MLS. And this cup final, there's real hype in Atlanta here. You can walk through downtown Atlanta and the bars are buzzing with it. People are walking around in Atlanta United scarves, and you feel it. You feel like, oh man, I just walked into a place where a soccer cup final is about to happen, which is more than you can say for most towns in the United States. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a good match. Atlanta United plays a very appealing, attacking style. The Portland Timbers are not going to shy away from Atlanta United. I think a lot of people think that they're just going to bunker and wait for Atlanta United to break them down. I highly doubt that's going to happen. I've already got predictions in my mind. I'm expecting at least between the two teams, I'm expecting 5 goals total.
Well, that sounds like a pretty high-scoring game. Just sort of thinking about the atmosphere, the buzz in Atlanta at the moment, I wonder if there's some analogy for when, you know, a couple of years ago when Orlando was awarded that MLS franchise, there was a lot of excitement. I mean, there still is a lot of excitement, but do you get the sense at all, Jordan Culver, that some of that enthusiasm over soccer has evaporated a wee bit with the fortunes of the team in recent years?
I mean, if you look at my Twitter mentions, probably no. I think there's still a very real, very passionate, dedicated fan base for Orlando City. They just want to see results. I think that these fans are intelligent. They want to see a good product put onto the pitch. And I don't think that the passion has dwindled. I think the passion is in a bit of a holding pattern now at this point, just waiting for something to really cheer for and to really root for. They're waiting for something to really get behind. Mm-hmm. So when you go into Orlando City Stadium, when that place is packed, it's an atmosphere unlike anything else. Mm-hmm. When it's not packed, you can tell. And so I think the fans are going to come right back out at the start of the season again, at the start of next season. But if there's nothing to cheer for, they're not going to show up. And you can't expect fans to show up if there's nothing to cheer for.
Yep. Getting a tweet here from Vanessa Travel Media, actually tackling all three of these sports we're talking about at the moment. Looking at our sports team, the UCF Knights are cracking their heads on the CFB playoff glass ceiling, while Orlando City Soccer are looking at a 2-year rebuild under James O'Connor. But the Orlando Magic are definitely on a firmer footing, a very different team recently. Let me just talk about that soccer piece of that comment there for a moment. Jordan, the coach, James O'Connor, he kind of was brought in halfway through the season, the Magic trying to do some damage control or trying to rebuild a little bit. Has he seen any results, or is it going to take more than half a season, or more than at least another season for us to see some success under the leadership of James O'Connor?
I think it's going to take some time. It's obviously taking more than the half season that he got. James O'Connor's record was not pleasant over this half season that he had. I think any time you bring in a coach midway through and you start what is essentially a brand new sort of rebuilding plan and a brand new way of thinking and doing things and going about things, it's going to take time. So James O'Connor, I think, is going to need more than just one season at the helm. If this season doesn't go well for James O'Connor, I don't think you turn the page as quickly as you did with the other coaches. I think you've got to give the man some time, let him implement a system, let him get some players in. It looks like Orlando City is trying to go the player development route. That seems like the plan now for the future. Develop the players. They relaunched OCB. Orlando City B is very much now about we're going to develop the younger players. It's not going to be a spot to park those journeyman players or the players that aren't getting first team minutes. It's about developing young new talent and getting it ready for the first team. And then you bring in a GM from one of the most respected player development organizations in FC Dallas. It's all signs are pointing to the player development route.
Mm-hmm. And let's not forget, too, James O'Connor is no stranger to Orlando. He actually played before Orlando City got its MLS franchise, right? So he sort of comes into Orlando with people know who he is, at least soccer fans do, and I feel like there's probably a bit of goodwill there, and they're prepared to give him that time maybe to get this team up and running.
That goodwill will evaporate if he doesn't produce. I've learned that very, very quickly. With like I said, Orlando City fans, they want to see results. They want to see it's not even just about wins. They want to see good, competitive soccer. The wins are important, but they want to support at least an attractive team, and they want to know what they're getting behind. So I do think he has some goodwill. I do think that goodwill will go away very quickly if things go south this season.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about a team that's doing a little bit better, at least in their sports, and that is the Orlando Magic. And Philip Rossman-Reich, I want to ask you. They've had a pretty good start to the season. What are you seeing going right for them? Because they didn't come into this with particularly high expectations.
Yeah, I think something that's really changed is their mentality and approach to the season and to the games. They have a new coach in Steve Clifford as well, so it seems like a lot of new coaches in town. But he's really helped change kind of the identity and culture around the group, whereas the last few years where they've really struggled, they've kind of been hit in the mouth, so to speak, where a team will put a big run on them and take the lead and they just don't really fight back. This year they've had several times where they've lost big leads, where they've been down and they've fought back and found a way to eke out wins. Mm-hmm. it hasn't always been pretty with them and they probably still have a long way to go, but their willingness to be resilient and to fight back has created results on the court, and you can really see them buying in and believing that they can win games again.
And you see that, you credit the coach to that. He doesn't, when you look at him on the sidelines, he's not like the most demonstrative of coaches, right? He's got a frown on his face, it seems, whether they're doing well or not.
Yeah, I definitely credit Steve Clifford because, essentially this is very much the same roster as last year. And Steve Clifford, was an assistant under Stan Van Gundy, who everyone in this town knows as a kind of hard-driving, demanding coach. He's not as demonstrative as he said, but when he was the head coach with the Charlotte Bobcats and then the Charlotte Hornets, he really helped change that team around. He's very straightforward, has clear expectations for his team and demands that they meet those expectations and helps them in every way that he can to get there. And that's, the Magic have had a kind of revolving door of coaches over mm-hmm. the last 6 years. Having someone that sets those expectations so clearly and sets that standard so clearly has been a huge help to a young team like this one.
They have some really promising players on their roster, right? Mo Bamba is an exciting player. People kind of enjoy watching him play. He's just one of them. Are you seeing one player as a real standout or somebody who could develop into the player that, that everybody else sort of gels around?
I think that's still to be determined. I mean, I think the guy who has really stepped up to the plate this year has been someone that's been with this team since they traded Dwight Howard, and that's Nikola Vucevic. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people had almost completely written him off in a lot of ways as someone who can put up good numbers but couldn't contribute to a winning team for whatever reason. And this year, he's been clearly an NBA All-Star level player. He's been clearly someone that the Magic trust to kind of run their offense. You know, you don't see a lot of centers with high assist numbers. I think the last time I looked, he was fourth among centers in assists, averaging, you know, between 3 and 4 assists per game, mm-hmm. Which doesn't sound like a lot before, you know, you don't typically think of big men as passing the ball, but he's been playing at an extremely high level offensively as a shooter, as a scorer, but also his defense has taken a big step up. But among those young players, it certainly feels like Aaron Gordon is about to take another leap in his game. He obviously had a big season last year, but mm-hmm. Something that Steve Clifford has really tried to get him to do is round his entire game into form where he's not just a scorer, not just trying to score. His defense has taken a big leap up, and even his passing's been a lot better, and his decision-making's been a lot better. So there's definitely a maturing going on among a lot of the Magic players this year.
The commentary you hear, too, people enjoy saying Vucevic's name when he scores. Yeah. And what about Evan Fournier? What are we seeing from him this season?
Evan's had a rough season. I think what's both frustrating about the season so far and maybe a little bit exciting is that there have been a lot of guys who have played extremely well, but there's also been several players that this team knows can play a lot better, and Evan Fournier is one of them. He's been, for the last 2 years, he's been the team's leading scorer at the end of the season, and while he's still putting up a lot of points, he's not shooting the ball as effectively and efficiently as he could be, and I think the Magic have also given him a little bit more playmaking responsibility, so he's been making some mistakes off the dribble a little bit, but I think the Magic still have a lot of faith that his shooting numbers will come back to form, and when that happens, you know, they already have a pretty potent offense, surprisingly. It'll only get better when that happens.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about sports in the City Beautiful. You can join the conversation 1-866-338-5252. Taking your comments and questions on Twitter as well. Maybe you're a Magic fan. Maybe you're enjoying the run of success they're having in the first quarter of this NBA season so far. Perhaps you are kind of licking your wounds a bit as a soccer fan, hoping for something better next season. And maybe you're riding high on the success of UCF, but hoping that at some point they can somehow make their way into a final playoff spot. You can also send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Getting something here from Bruce Claymore. He writes, UCF is suffering the same problem Boise Street had a few years ago. They need to play and win a game against a top team, but those teams don't want to risk a loss to UCF. Dig into that a little bit, if you could, Jeff. How does that work? I mean, can UCF throw down the gauntlet to a team and say, play us?
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, there's no doubt that Danny White, the athletic director for UCF, has gone out and said, look, we want to try and get some of these, you know, power conference schools on our schedule in their non-conference section of that schedule. But the listener makes a good point that a lot of these schedules, obviously they have to be agreements between the two schools, and a lot of these schools are scheduling games. I think I saw one school that scheduled games out into the 2030s in terms of their non-conference schedule, which, you know, in a 12-game regular season, you play 8 or 9 conference games depending upon which conference you're in, and the other are filled with these non-conference matchups. So, and they're kind of intersectional, if you will, between teams from different regions. The problem is, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy in that some of these schools do not want to play UCF because they are fearful that a loss to UCF could sink their entire season if they have a shot to get into the playoff. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, UCF is out here saying, look, we'll play anybody, but we're not going to do what a lot of these power conferences do and schedule, say, what we call a 2-for-1, where UCF will play twice at school X and they'll only come once to Orlando. UCF was like, no, we want to get a good attendance figure and the revenue that comes with it from it playing from you coming to our place.
Mm-hmm.
You get one game in return, and then we can see if we can do this again. But we're not going to give you all of the benefit and have only have us do a little, get a little bit of it. So it's a tough spot because, you know, it, let's say UCF does play somebody good like they did this year. They played Pitt, who was the runner-up in the ACC. They beat them 45-14. And then the line after that was, well, it's Pitt. You know, because Pitt, you know, they didn't exactly have a spectacular record. They got blown out by Clemson in the ACC championship game. But nonetheless, you know, they were there. So that goes back to one thing I was mentioning earlier, is that the goalposts seem to move amongst the playoff committee when it comes to teams like UCF. Boise State was another one a couple years back. TCU and Utah, before they actually joined power conferences, it was the same situation.
Is it just do they just need to get on Twitter more and at some of these teams? Is
that there's no shortage of Twitter traffic coming from coming out of UCF's orbit. That's for sure. And that's
speaking of orbit, it's not just UCF. We have the likes of Jim Bridenstine weighing in, the NASA administrator. Yeah. So there's some pretty high profile backers for UCF there. But that's not really the way it works, is it?
Unfortunately, no. And I did see that tweet from Jim Bridenstine. Interestingly enough, I think that. From UCF's perspective, nothing's really going to change with this playoff system until the television contract runs out in the mid-2020s. At that point, we might see some conference realignment between some of the various schools. And then, who knows, maybe UCF does get into a conference that has a little bit better access to the college football playoff. Maybe the college football playoff expands to perhaps 8 teams. That's been bandied about quite a bit. But until there's some system of... as my friend Eric Lopez, who writes for us on the site, says, criteria where, you know, like in the NCAA basketball tournament, if you win your conference, you get an automatic bid. Unless you have some sort of criteria similar to that in the college football playoff selection, there's still a good chance, even if they expand to 8 or 12 or 16 or what have you, that a team like UCF may still be excluded if you're leaving it to a group of people behind closed doors.
All right. So it could be some bitter UCF fans out there for years to come still. Let me just bring you back to the conversation real quick. Jordan Culver, what about the Pride? How did they do this season?
So the Pride had a pretty wide collection of talent that never coalesced on the field. So they ended up finishing outside the playoffs. They went on a 4-match losing streak to end the season. I think it was a 6 total without a win to end the season after being in a good playoff position. And so that ended with Coach Tom Sermonti and the rest of the organization parting ways. So now they're still looking for a coach. And before they get a coach in, they have to get a full-time GM officially announced and in. And now it's they're going to be without Sydney LaRue probably for a little bit. Sydney LaRue, who was their top goal scorer last year, she announced that she was pregnant. Congratulations to her. But it means the Pride are going to be without their top goal scorer for a little bit. If you ask how the Pride did, they didn't perform to expectations. They had all the talent in the world in Marta and Alex Morgan and Sydney LaRue and Alana Kennedy in the midfield, and they had so many different players and national team players and a strong leadership in Allie Krieger and Ashlyn Harris, and they didn't make the playoffs. So there's no other way to describe that season but a disappointment.
So some rebuilding all around for soccer fans in the City Beautiful. Just some final thoughts from you, Philip Rossman-Reich. What does the Magic need to do for the next part of the season to kind of keep this run of success going?
They certainly have to tighten up their defense. I know that's something that Steve Clifford has kind of built a reputation on around the league and something that this group is still struggling a little bit. But really, it's still about building confidence and, as I like to say, learning how to win. You know, this is a group that hasn't won a lot of games in the past 5-6 years, and this is all a new experience. I think I saw this is the deepest the Magic have been at 500. They're 12-13 now, but the deepest they've been at 500 since 2015, and they were 19-13 in January that year, and won only 2 games in the month of January to fall out of the playoff race. So it's going to be a lot of new experiences for this group to stay in the playoff race and to continue building that confidence to win.
Well, Philip Rossman-Reich is the editor at Orlando Magic Daily, host of the podcast Locked On Magic. Thank you, Philip.
Thank you very much.
Jordan Culver is a staff writer at ProSoccerUSA.com up in Atlanta at the moment for the MLS final. Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you.
And Jeff Sharon, managing editor of the Black and Gold Bannerets, all things UCF. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Matthew. Always good to see you.
Up next, e-cigarettes were developed to wean smokers off cigarettes. Now, pediatricians are worried they're introducing a whole new generation to nicotine. Cutting through the haze around vaping, that's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Federal authorities are moving to restrict the sale of e-cigarettes at gas stations and convenience stores. It's part of a push to get e-cigarettes out of the hands of teenagers. Vaping advocates say it will have an impact on people who are using e-cigarettes to try and quit smoking, but pediatricians say the restrictions are a good first step. For more, we're joined by Dr. Candace Jones. She's a pediatrician in Pine Hills, Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So there's quite a lot of focus on e-cigarettes and vaping, and especially this year, because there have been some restrictions put in place on how companies that make e-cigarettes and vape pens can sell them and market them. What are you seeing from the point of view of a pediatrician? Like, I wonder if we could start with the rate of vaping you might be seeing in teenagers, for example.
Right. I do have patients that I have spoke to about vaping, and they are doing it. But what we know statistically nationwide, that this year alone, there was about 3 million high schoolers and about 570,000 middle schoolers documented to be using e-cigarettes. And that's an increase, pretty much an increase each year over the past few years.
Do you know how much it's going up?
I don't remember the number, the percentage, but that is an increase reported by the CDC, and this is epidemic level.
Candace Jones, what are you seeing? Like, you do have some patients who say that they vape. What are they telling you?
So the impression I'm getting from them, it's no big deal. It's safe. It's better. I'm not smoking cigarettes. Cigarettes are yucky, you know, that type of thing. So they really have an impression that it's safe. It's okay. It's just like a vapor water, and it has flavor, and it's cool.
And at the point that you see them, are you seeing like health symptoms from it? Like, you know, what you might, the kind of problems you might see associated with smoking cigarettes?
Well, I will say the few patients that I have are more in the late adolescent, heading to a young adulthood. And they do have some health issues. Those particular patients, some mental health concerns, and I feel like it's a form of medicating, and they have no idea that there's nicotine in there and that they may be developing a dependence or addiction with the nicotine. They don't know that part of it. And so when I tell them that and help them to realize that they may be addicted to this e-cigarette because they're doing it all day, several times a day, and ask them if they can stop, you know, that's a question mark for them. They're not sure.
What about the health risks of vaping or e-cigarettes compared to smoking cigarettes? Are there some benefits, or is there a difference in puffing on a vape pen rather than smoking a cigarette?
Well, I will say there is ongoing research to try to tease that out. What we do know is that these products were made for adults, okay, as a way to stop smoking or as a route to quitting smoking. But we do know now that the vaping solution still has cancer-causing substances in it. Maybe not the 3,000 or so that's in smoking a cigarette, but there's still formaldehyde-like solutions, cancer-causing substances that are burned out of the vape. Also, there's still nicotine addiction. And some of the vaping, the electronic cigarettes, nicotine is just as high as the cigarette. So you still have to deal with addiction.
And what about nicotine itself? I mean, aside from the fact that it's addictive, what are the side effects of of using nicotine on a regular basis?
Right. So addiction is probably the biggest thing we talk about, as you said. But you also have to worry about the body effects of nicotine. In and of itself, it's a carcinogen. It also affects every part of the body. GI problems, upper respiratory, pulmonary inflammation. Blood pressure concerns. So it affects every system of the body. It acts sort of like on receptors and messes with neurotransmitters and things of that nature, the nervous system.
Mm-hmm. And that would be something you would see symptoms of in an adolescent or a teenager who tells you that they vape on a regular basis?
You could see that, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It affects, and you know what's so sad about with young people, what's so scary, I would say, is that the reason why I'm so concerned about this in pediatricians is because children, adolescents, young adults still have developing bodies, developing brains, developing nervous systems. And we don't know really the full effects on their bodies that's still growing and developing.
Do you think, Dr. Candace Jones, that if these kids you're talking about weren't vaping, they wouldn't be ingesting nicotine in any form at all, or would they be smoking cigarettes?
That's a good question. Absolutely. And I do have patients who smoke cigarettes and smoke mm-hmm. marijuana and do all sorts of things. But do we give them more avenues? You know, if it's not safe, it's not safe. I'm going to speak to all of it. Mm-hmm. I don't want them smoking cigarettes. I don't want them vaping. I don't want them doing marijuana. I talk to them about all these dangers. We want them to have a drug-free body.
The science around the dangers of smoking cigarettes or smoking tobacco in other forms is pretty well documented, though, right? I mean, there's decades of research on that. You mentioned the number of chemicals that you
right.
would be ingesting into your body by smoking a cigarette. Does there just need to be more research on what the impacts of vaping may be before you can kind of conclusively say this is, you know, there are sort of risks associated with this on par with smoking cigarettes?
Absolutely. I think the research is ongoing. It really is, and we'll have more information. But what I would say as a pediatrician and supporting the stance of the American Academy of Pediatrics is that right now what we do know is not safe enough for kids. Mm-hmm. And we definitely don't want 3 million high schoolers and 570,000 middle schoolers using e-cigarettes. And I think everyone. I was on the local news station with this story. It's very short clips, and I got some pushback from a vaping company here locally.
Mm-hmm.
And once I sent him, I didn't argue, I educate, I don't debate. Once I sent him articles and data and information, he clearly put on his social media and back to me very nice message of, I understand your concern. This is not for kids. Mm-hmm. I get it.
But what about the fact that it's flavored? I mean, you talk about the fact that these solutions they come in a range of flavors, right?
Right.
Does that make them more attractive?
Yes.
And I wonder if you can have some examples of this from the kids that you've talked to. Is part of the reason they're doing it because they come in these flavors which sort of mask? It would be a different experience from smoking a cigarette, right?
Right, absolutely. And I think that's the part of the marketing and the targeting there. I was just in a gas station yesterday, and even after these regulations have come out, obviously they haven't taken effect because Juul was right there where I was paying, at point of sale where I was paying for my products that I had bought. Mm-hmm. Juul, and I saw creme brulee, mint, berry, cool cucumber, bubble. I mean, I saw so many, like, oh, this is why it's attractive. I can see them sitting here having a fun discussion about which flavor they're going to try today.
What do you think could be done at the federal level, even at the state or local level, to address some of the concerns that you and other pediatricians or other medical professionals might have?
Absolutely. So I think that the FDA has a good start. The report that they've put out in the first stage of restrictions. So that's in process and has been done. And hopefully they will look at the effects of that. I know that takes time and make those adjustments. But what they've initially, their initial plan has been to limit the way they're, that basically limit the appeal and the access to young people.
Mm-hmm.
And so changing the way they're sold in stores, age restricted storefronts, potentially also limiting the online access, maybe increasing that age, and banning flavors in cigars and cigarettes and some of the flavorings, the targeted flavorings for the e-cigarettes for that are particularly interesting to the young people. And they also have sent that charge out to the industry leaders. For instance, Juul did respond, and that's one of the most popular ones with kids, with young people. They did respond and pretty much are shutting some of their social media down on the advertising and marketing of the product, also increasing their online sales, making adjustments there, and some of the flavorings. So I applaud all of this. And I think our stance as pediatrician is just make it tough and make it hard. And really, maybe those things that are particularly of interest to the young people just need to come off the market because, you know, we know they still find a way to try to get them.
What's your message then for kids you might see who say, I vape and I think it's okay, or even if you're, you know, talking to other pediatricians and they're sort of bringing up concerns too, like what's your strategy? What do you tell kids?
Right. I think in the in practice, I definitely ask the question. We just have to ask. You know, there's so many questions we have to ask our young people about everything. And so I just, you know, kick the parent out of the room. Sometimes that's not easy. And I just ask them all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I tell them it's all about their health. Everything they do affects their health. And I just want them to be healthy and well and have the best chance at life. And they open up. And so I just have my little checklist. You know, you smoke marijuana? When's the last time you? And if I get the right response, they usually will tell me. And so for those particular patients that I've had that told me that they smoke e-cigarettes, I just educate them with knowledge. I go, okay, what do you think about them? Most of the time they think they're safe. Mm-hmm. And then I say, well, did you know that that liquid still has substances in there that can cause cancer? Like cigarettes. Oh, no, I didn't know that. Well, did you know that there's nicotine? There's more than likely nicotine in that substance, and this is what nicotine can do. Oh, okay. And did you know that this increases your risk for trying other things?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so really this is not the best thing for you. What? And then trying to arm them with other things. What else could you be doing? A lot of times I find, and I'm not stereotyping, but sometimes these are teens that don't have other positive coping skills or other things to be doing. So we need to find them some other positive outlets, some other things to be doing besides that.
Mm-hmm. And does it work?
I think that if we reach one, that's my goal. If I get one, if I can teach you something, and then I'm going to ask you about it next time, and then I'm going to try to get you to let me talk to you and your mom about it so we can talk to you more about it. I think I definitely have been successful. And those few patients, when I see them again, I will be asking.
Well, Candace Jones is a pediatrician in Pine Hills, Orlando. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still to come, new music from Mark with a C. That's when Intersection returns.
Soon the jitters have got to go away. Things can't always be so dang on.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando singer-songwriter Mark with a C has been performing and recording for nearly two decades. His 13th album, Obscurity, was recorded in Canada and released earlier this year. And he's also in the running for a Grammy nomination with the video for his song One of These Are Gonna Be Your Day. Mark with a C joins us in studio now with a performance of One of These Are Gonna Be Your Day from the album Obscurity.
You won't be jumping out of your skin forever. Pretty soon the jitters have gotta go away. Things can't always be so dang untethered. Pretty soon it might just be okay. Though it's tough to say, since it sounds so cliche, like a rhyme scheme that goes A-A-A. You can use this song like lingerie, you can stain it up once and throw it away. One of these are gonna be your day. So look at your pulse and really think about it. display. Oh, that's tough to say since it sounds so cliche, like a rhyme scheme that goes A-A-A. When Gilmore led the Floyd Brigade, they still had on the turning away, and one of these are gonna be yours. Of what we know is temporary, just a few sleeps and the bad dwindles away. You can search for islands that you don't get, or you can be your own Daniel Faraday. Though it's tough to say since it sounds so cliche, like a rhyme scheme that goes A-A-A. If you're in a hole you didn't make, well, maybe it's just Special K, but one of these are gonna be your day. One of these are gonna be your day.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. That's Mark with a C with a song called One of These Are Gonna Be Your Day. Well, Mark with a C, thanks for joining us again on Intersection.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've got a new album under your belt called Obscurity. Tell me a little bit about the process of making this. You recorded it in Canada. It's the vinyl, at least, is pressed somewhere in Europe.
Yeah, the vinyl is blue, pink, and purple swirl, and it's pressed in the Czech Republic, mm-hmm. actually. But yeah, I went to Canada to record this album with the producer that I'd wanted to work with since I was a teenager. It was my aspiration to work with a guy named Jordan Zatarozny. He was the head of a band named Blinker the Star in the 90s. And then later, he co-wrote some songs for the band Hole. He started producing records by Melissa Oftermar, who was his friend, I think, in high school. And then produced stuff for Chris Cornell, Sam Roberts' band. But importantly, his Blinker the Star stuff moved me in ways I can't even describe. There were tones I'd never heard, and I was like, oh, one day I'll be okay enough that Jordan will go, it's okay, Mark, bring me your songs. I'll make them good. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I made it to that level, and I got to spend 2 weeks in the Canadian outback with Jordan while we made a record and I fought an awful Canadian cold.
So Canadian outback, is this where exactly is it?
It was in a place called Pembroke, Ontario. Mm-hmm. But I was there around May of 2017, and there was no snow or anything to be found. All the stuff they tell you about Canada, surprisingly, it actually looks a lot like the woods in Lake County, Florida. There's a lot of hills and green, and there's actually mosquitoes. They never tell you. Mm-hmm. This is not a joke. There are straight up mosquitoes, swarms of mosquitoes at night, because what else are they going to do? All that snow melted. Mm-hmm. So, and at night it sounds like Lake County too. It sounds like you hear frogs and crickets. It sounds a lot like Florida.
Did you get inspiration for some of your songs while you were making the album, or did you go with a full, like a full disc's worth of songs?
All the songs were pretty much written. There were a couple of lyrics that we changed in the studio. One thing that was changed by Canada was I loved the sound of night in the middle of nowhere. So on the very first song on the record, Old Man Yells at iCloud, we stuck some condenser microphones outside to capture the sound of the Canadian outback. And then I was like, nobody's going to believe that I didn't record this in Florida. But what we ultimately found was that Canada is a lot windier than Florida. So all we got in the microphone was that whoosh, whoosh, whoosh noise. So I have previously been so lo-fi, just like stick a boombox in the corner, press record, and maybe it'll pick me up. That's the extent of my recording quality, right? So Obscurity, to record the Canadian outback, we had to duct tape paper towels around the microphone. So we still got a little bit of lo-fi there. I was inspired by the sound of Canada, literally the sound of Canada. Plus, I love a lot of Canadian groups. So mm-hmm. it was really cool to just walk into any store and hear like deep Rush cuts playing. They're really proud of Rush up there, and by God, they ought to be.
There are some Canadian bands that are huge in Canada, but they've never really made much of an impact, you know, south of the border, right?
Yeah, especially Tragically Hip and Sloan. Mm-hmm. Sloan, I think, is the big crime. We basically have a Beatles right now, a Beatles that continues with four distinct songwriters' personalities. They all take turn leading.
and their songs, well, okay, the jury's out. Are they as good as the Beatles? I don't know. But they're basically doing the Beatles model, and they're doing it well. And up there, they're opening for the Rolling Stones. When they come here, they're lucky to play the Social.
So what's the last few years been like for you? You've achieved that dream of working with this producer.
Well, I've been working on a podcast for Consequence of Sound, the Consequence Podcast Network. It's called Discography, and it's basically each season I take a deep dive into the entire catalog of one act. So say season two was Janet Jackson. The deal is that I review Janet Jackson's career, but I don't use the music videos. I don't use gossip. I only use what is on the record. I use the liner notes from the record, and that's all the information I'm allowed to make my dissertation of the record. I judge the record by its own merits and only its own merits. I think too often we have a hard time separating art from artist. Myself, I am the worst at it. I'm terrible at it. And it's a little therapeutic for me, but it's also just really good fun to like imagine that they don't have these larger than life personalities and to imagine this is a random person walking into a vocal booth who doesn't know when they open their mouth if the song's going to be good or not. To think about it that way, that from conception to it being a worldwide smash, there was probably self-doubt. We don't ever look at records that way anymore. We think everybody who sings a song must be the most confident, and we're all battling imposter syndrome unless we're psychopaths. That said, beyond hosting Discography for Consequence, the video for the most recent single from Obscurity, One of These Are Gonna Be Your Day, ended up being on the official Grammy ballot for Best Music Video, and it was directed by Tim Labonte and Madison Durand.
So you're up for a Grammy.
I am in the running on the ballot to be nominated. I am not nominated yet, but I am in the what people have referred to as preliminary rounds. Never once did the guy who makes up songs about squids in his garage ever aspire to being on a Grammy ballot, but I'll take it. Mostly what I trust Tim to do when he makes videos for me is give me a good interpretation of the song. And there's a story told in the One of These Are Gonna Be Your Day video that is absolutely not the story told in the song. However, when you take that story in the lyrics and the story told in the video, you get a new story, and it became greater than the sum of its parts. And that is something that music video doesn't always do. And it's really a happy accident that this happened because it was through no direction of my own. I cannot stress enough, I was not in the state. The video was late being delivered. Like, it's a complete accident that this thing got the attention that it did. But if I can only be remembered for one song, and this is the serious truth, if I only get to be remembered for one song, this is the one I would have picked. When I wrote this, I was not in a good place. And if I hadn't gotten the sentiments out, I might not have seen the end of that day. So I said it early on in a really early tune of mine that some folks got tattooed on their bodies. Music can heal, and that song healed me. So maybe it'll be good for other people too.
Well, Mark with a C, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you coming back and performing for us and talking a little bit about your music.
This was such a blast. Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for listening to what I had to say.
To take us out, here's Mark with a C performing Please Don't Let My Art Die.
I'd say I don't want a funeral, but nobody would listen. Funerals are like birthday parties, and they ain't always about the victim. What matters is how it feels when all the attendees leave. Like once I was at a funeral and I heard my song sung back to me.
And that's Mark with a C performing Please Don't Let My Art Die. You can catch him at the Geek Easy this Saturday performing his annual marathon holiday show. And on our website, WMFE.org, you can hear the bonus track Perfect For Me. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Shania Richburg. Production assistance from Juan Gualda. Subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.
'Cause it's about the only thing I did right with my life. I tried so hard.